So please join me in welcoming Chris Smith from the Colorado Health Foundation, who's going to talk about how Colorado is using cross-sector collaboration to become the healthiest state in the nation. Chris?
Good morning, everybody. How are you all today? I hope you can hear me pretty well. Well, Annie Warhova couldn't be here today, but don't fret. You didn't get the back of the bus here. She sent me because of the nature of what this conversation is all about. It's talking about cross-sector partnerships, and she's very proud of the fact that I don't fit in a sense, of the work that we do at the Colorado Health Foundation, working with a group of people that come a lot from the public health background, and I'm not in that area. I actually am an architect, and I'm an urban designer. And I came to the Health Foundation to a certain extent because of my own travels. You know, I had been 50 pounds heavier than I am now. And as I started going through the process of trying to say, how do I address my own health, I went through what I saw to be a rather middle-class solution to that. You know, you join a gym, you know, you buy a bike, you do some things like that, and you go to your doctor, and they tell you this is what you need to do. But if you think about my response to addressing that and put it into the context of dealing with working with lower income people who maybe don't have adequate health insurance and don't have the ability to be able to join a gym and don't have the ability to be able to take that kind of make that kind of effort to address their own health, you find that doing that is much more challenging. And what you find and what I found is that when you look at the built environment and the places in which we live, they're really designed in a sense to make people unhealthy. And so as an architect and a planner, I see myself as being part of that challenge and trying to address that moving forward in the future. So I came to the Colorado Health Foundation. I'm a senior program officer, and I'm on the healthy living team within the Health Foundation. And the areas that I work on primarily is helping us to develop our refinement to our strategy around healthy communities. We talk about how we can create healthier communities. Part of my goal is to help us to be able to develop a comprehensive strategy to do that. But let me tell you a little bit about the Health Foundation. As Michelle mentioned, we have a vision within the Colorado Health Foundation, which is to make Colorado the healthiest state in the nation. So it's easy to say, hard to do, right? How are we going to address that challenge to make Colorado a healthiest state in the nation? We have three outcome areas, but the two that are the traditional outcome areas within the Health Foundation are the ones that you see at the bottom of this slide. The health coverage, where our goal within health coverage is to make sure that everybody in the state of Colorado has adequate health coverage, and then that the depth of that coverage is actually good, so that they're not underinsured. So we want to make sure that people have that, so that when they are sick, they can be able to go to a doctor. And then health care, which is our other area where we do a lot within clinics and federally qualified health centers and all of that type of work, to make sure that when people do go to see the doctor, that the quality of the care that they receive is high. So those are the two traditional areas that we have within the Health Foundation. The third area, which is the newest, and you all are probably seeing this yourself, is that as we start to get convergence between what the areas of public health is doing and running into the challenges associated with our built environment, as these areas start to overlap, the Health Foundation realized that it was important for us to start to address that overlap. And so the newest area that we have within the foundation is this healthy living area, which is really focused on trying to create the opportunities for preventing folks from getting sick in the first place and preventing folks from having to address chronic conditions that frankly our area deals with a lot. It's how do we actually address that on the front end to try to get at that challenge. So there's six primary tools that we use. I'm not going to speak about all six of these, but two that I want to point out is on the grant-making side. You know, we have Robert Wood Johnson here, and sometimes we think ourselves like the little sort of the brother or sister of Robert Wood Johnson. We are the third largest health-focused foundation in the United States, and we grant on an annual basis between grants and investments about $100 million across the state of Colorado to try to address the work that we do. The second area that I want to talk a that I want to mention here is private sector investments. The Colorado Health Foundation is a relatively new foundation. We were formed out of the sale of our equity stake that we had in the Health One Hospital Network, and that's created the basis for the foundation's grant-making ability, and we became a private philanthropy. And just recently, we started looking at private sector investments because we realized that as a private foundation, focusing primarily on nonprofit was not going to be enough for us to be able to fundamentally address the challenge of making Colorado the healthiest state in the nation. We had to open up the opportunity for us to be able to talk to business and to be able to address the market-based challenges of that also. So recently we started doing mission-related investments and private-related investments, PRI investments, so that we could start working with for-profit businesses. So some of the partners that we work with to address this work are across the board, as you could imagine, and that's a big part of what we're talking about today. So as I mentioned, nonprofit organizations, of course, we work with those. That's really our core group, and it's easier for me sometimes, I think, when we talk about the work that we do in Colorado, when people ask, well, who do you work with, it's easier for me to say, who don't we work with as far as nonprofit organizations in the state, because we do really work across those three areas. Some of the larger organizations that we work with really on the healthy living side would be an organization that we helped to create with Kaiser Permanente called Live Well Colorado, which is an advocacy group. Some of you might have heard of them. And we also recently created a lobbying organization called Healthier Colorado. As our focus changed to a private foundation, we could no longer lobby, so we moved out of that area. But we did create a new organization that's called Healthier Colorado that focuses on that work within the state. So it has the same mission as us: healthy living, health coverage, and health care, but they're able to lobby and to change policy within the state of Colorado. We work with other foundations, as I mentioned, Kaiser being one that we work with a lot, and many of the other foundations, Piton, El Pomar, what have you, within the state of Colorado. Policy, of course, is an area that we focus on, as I mentioned, and some of the work that we've done to try to create an organization to specifically address that. And we do a lot of work with the Colorado Department for Public Health and Environment, so state agencies and departments. But I also want to say we go down to local level because we're trying to work across the board. So when we're trying to change this idea of communities and how we actually influence the way communities are designed to develop and the decisions that are making at that local level, because you think of all the decisions that are made every day in terms of the quality of the environment that people live in, and what we find is that we have to make sure that we're speaking in a language that those decision makers are hearing. And I know it may be sort of news to you, but all of those decision makers don't always think about health and the focus of what they need to work on first, right? They think about other things, and health is important, but that's not really at the top of their list, especially if you're looking at a local level and you're running a city. Business and civic doctors, you know, across the board. So the three outcome areas that we have within the foundation are these, as I mentioned, the Apple being the prevention side. That's funny, right? Healthy living. But the goal there that we have is that all Colorado kids should be fit and healthy. Our challenge there is over the course of the past year, we've come up with a 10-year strategy to try to address moving forward our goals within the state of Colorado. For the healthy living team, the focus is on trying to reduce the level of child obesity in Colorado to below 10% by 2023. We are somewhere right now floating around 14.5% to 16%. Our evaluators can get pretty particular about that. And you know, I think of it this way. It's higher than 10. We're trying to get it below 10%. So really, that's where the focus is. And that's where our area focuses on. The health coverage is to make sure that all Coloradans have a stable and affordable health and adequate health coverage. And then health care focuses on this. All Coloradans should have support from a network of primary health care and community services. So the Healthy Living Team, as I mentioned to you a little bit, is the newest area. It's actually growing to be one of the larger areas within the Health Foundation. And we focus primarily in two areas. The school side of our equation, and then the healthy community side. So if you think of our structure sort of very simply, within healthy living, we say we're going to address what happens in the school environment because of how much time children spend in school, and then healthy communities, the outside of school. That's another way to think about it. The reason why we're focusing in this area is that through our process that we've gone to revise our strategy over the past year, we decided that it wasn't going to be possible for us to focus or to do our work across the full range. When I joined the foundation a couple of years ago, we funded from children, early childhood development, all the way to seniors dealing with chronic disease management. We had to make a decision, even with the capacity that we have to be able to do work, that we couldn't work across that full range. And looking at Colorado, and when you see the studies that come out annually with the Colorado Health Institute talking about the letter grades that they give to the health of the people within the state, the adults do pretty well. What we found is that the children are substantially lagging behind with Colorado. So what that's meaning to us is that even though the adults are motivated to have these more active sort of a lifestyle, the children are falling sort of prey to the same challenges that children across the United States are falling prey to, in that they don't have access to easy ways to be healthy and the like, and that for example, within the state of Colorado, we're one of, I think, of only two states in the country that don't have a mandatory physical education requirement in schools. So they're not getting the opportunity to be able to engage in these types of activities. So we focus on schools, we focus on communities. Our main areas are we look at food, trying to make sure that people have access to healthy food, and that people have easy access to physical activity and disease management tools. Within the work that we do, our goal is to promote healthy communities through culture change. Of course, that's a big part, is to try to change the culture. And it's amazing how challenging and how deep we have to go in trying to just fundamentally start to shift that culture that we have within not only Colorado, but across the nation to how we can promote health within the state. Our goal being healthy Coloradans, and we focus on, as I mentioned, the environment and then influencing behavior. So today we're going to talk a little bit about some of the things that we do. I don't think that, you know, for us to get into the conversation of the health benefits, you all know what a lot of the health benefits are in terms of trying to address health within the United States and for us in the state of Colorado. But we do know that if you have neighborhoods where you have sidewalks and you have trails and you have access to things that people can walk to, not just the idea, this idea of walking to sort of like or just on a trail, like just walking around on a trail, it's like recreation and it's like exercise. What we're talking about is communities where people can actually walk places to do something, right? It's not this idea of just walking because of, well, I want to get my exercise on. It's like I can actually walk someplace to do something. We want to create those kind of communities in Colorado and influence what's going on nationally. We know that for children, if they are living in areas that don't have access to these things, that they have higher rates of obesity. I mean, that's something that we find. And then spending, you know, we have an auto-oriented environment, and sometimes I get, you know, it's kind of frustrating. You get a little tired of going over and over. It's auto-oriented, yes, it is, right? What are we doing to change that, and how can we start to influence the decisions that are being made to change that? I look at city budgets, for example, in Denver. I used to work for the city and county of Denver. and I was the housing program manager, and I dealt with the low-income housing, from public housing all the way up to first-time home buyers. And what we find when you're dealing with things like auto-oriented environments is that the decision-making, for example, when we would develop a project, the city would say, well, we don't have any money to put in sidewalks. I was like, really? You don't have any money to put in sidewalks? You look at the budget and the amount of money that is spent on our infrastructure for our auto-oriented infrastructure is completely fully funded, right? But you don't have any dollars available to put in sidewalks. The developers would have to build the sidewalks themselves. Well, that creates, especially for affordable housing development, it creates an additional expense. And the irony being that while if you do that type of work, you're highly leveraged and you have very little money to develop your project, you have to build the sidewalks, but the city requires the affordable developers to build parking, sometimes structured parking, which can run in somewhere in the range of $3,000 a space for a surface lot to $30,000 a space for structured parking. And they had to pay for that as a requirement in the city's zoning requirements for how much parking that was required to put into a housing development. Now, if you're dealing with people that are making minimum wage or below, many don't even have cars because they can't afford them. What sense does it make to actually have them build that parking? This is the type of thinking and the type of change that we have to make. And what I try to communicate in doing this sort of cross-language, because I say to within the Health Foundation all the time, they're not hearing you because we don't know, they're not understanding what the challenge is in making that shift over to the other side of this question. So economic benefits, we know that there's economic benefits. If you do a walkable community, people tend to dwell more, they drive through a neighborhood, they spend more time, and I try not to focus specifically on bicycling, even though I'm a big bicyclist and I do my bike commuting and all that kind of stuff like that. But the truth is that when you have people that are passing through a community at a slower speed, they see more, and there's more of a dwell that occurs. And actually, they've shown that if you take a corridor that has no bicycle access on it and put bicycle access on it, it actually improves the sales for the shops that are along that corridor, assuming, of course, that you can get to it, right? You know, try to bike your into the drive-thru. I've done that before. And it's not fun. For every dollar that you invest in public health, in public transportation, you get $4 in economic returns. And you know, Portland has seen that there's been benefits to this, too. And we know that if you have a home that's in proximity to green space or to parks and things like that, those usually have higher values. These are things that we can find in communities across the United States, nothing unique to Colorado. This is something, just very quickly, it's something that we took. It reflects what the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation put together in terms of some of the distinctions between unhealthy community and healthy communities. You can kind of look down that and ask yourself, which side do you kind of prefer to be on, right? Do you want to be in the area where you have you're unsafe even if it's in daylight? Or do you want to be in areas where you have no parks, areas of physical activity? I think the majority of us would actually pick these areas on the right, but you'd be surprised in terms of developing urban spaces and suburban spaces or rural communities, how often we tend to focus on what's happening on the left side of this equation. And think about the own places where you live, and you might notice that. So the same thing, streets and sidewalks in disrepair. We don't build sidewalks. In the 50s, we stopped building sidewalks because, well, people weren't walking or people were not going to walk. This was the mindset of urban designers and planners at that time. You know, people are going to drive everywhere. Well, guess what? They're right. We do. And now we're looking at the need to sort of change and go in a different direction here. So what's some of the work that we do very quickly? It's sort of like a little quarterly magazine that we do. It's available on our website, and you can download it. This one is particularly good. I think it would be worth you taking a look at it if you're interested. But it's Health Elevations. You can go to our website, which is www.coloradohealth.org, and you can read this Health Elevations, and you'll see examples of some of the projects that we've been doing in the state, some of the work that we've done to try to promote this idea of healthy communities, and some of the partners that we're working with to do this type of work. But let me give you a couple of examples. I don't know if any of you have heard of this, but there was a program through the federal government. It was called HOPE 6. It's changed its name slightly. I try not to follow it because it's acronyms, and you all are probably familiar with that. But in a sense, we worked with the Denver Housing Authority to try to rethink the way public housing is developed. If you think of the way a lot of public housing is developed, it's sort of like lean, sort of like barrack-style housing, with the idea being that we'll put people in multi-unit development, we'll give them a lot of green space, and, you know, therefore it will be nice, it won't be so dense, put people in high towers. Problem is that people don't use those spaces, and so the redevelopment of public housing has been a big thing. The first speaker, Mr. Williams, he talked about East Lake in Atlanta, and there was an example of redeveloping a public housing development. This was 300 units of public housing. It was redeveloped with the Denver Housing Authority. The Health Foundation granted a substantial amount of dollars to this. And what we tried to do was to incorporate active design into this development. One of the big pieces that we did as in redeveloping this was an interactive stair. I always think it's funny as an architect to talk about a stair in a building, because when you walk into most buildings, what are you faced with? You're faced with an elevator, if it's a multi-story building, or maybe you have, in a place like this convention center, you have an escalator. By the way, where are the stairs in this building? How many of you all walked up the stairs, right? You can't. Even if you wanted to, you'd have to try to find them. This is the sort of change that we're trying to make. What we did here, which is interesting, is that this staircase is just, in my profession, this is called an egress stair. This is to get out of the building. The only reason why you'd use it to get out of the building. What we did is we put inside, essentially, it's like a light show, and it's got, like, music inside there. And could you imagine, kids, you push these buttons. I was thinking, push one button. We're adults. We push one button, and it plays a tune. And I'm thinking the little kids are going to go down that stair, push every single button, and make every noise possible. But if it makes it fun, and if it makes it interesting, and it makes it a draw, and it changes it from the nasty stairs that we can all think about, if you ever use the stairs in a multi-story building, you create the opportunity for people to be able to use that. And that's what we're trying to do. So interactive stairs, we did community gardens, we did trails, we did health navigators to help people to be able to figure out how to use, for example, the bike share program and different things like that were created. And this is all in public housing. And so that's the area that we're trying to make sure that we address. This is another one. It's the New Freedom Park. Very quickly, we took, well, come on, left to right. I don't really have to go too much into that, but we tried to make a big shift in the environment that people are living in and create something that would be a benefit to the residents. Once again, very low income, income assisted, and public housing. This is healthy food. We focus a lot on healthy food. This was an existing building, corner store. What we did, we changed it into not only a community garden, but also a retail store for healthy food in a community that had limited access to healthy food. We focused on that. We did that with Denver Urban Gardens and with a number of other nonprofit organizations. It even has like a little demonstration, like a teaching kitchen that we did within there, so that people can see actually how to prepare healthier foods. We work a lot with Share Our Strength, Cooking Matters Colorado, to help people develop skills. You know, not just knowledge. You know, eat healthy, right? You know, or here's how to, but give people the skills to be able to prepare healthy food for their family and then address the access. We created the Colorado Fresh Food Financing Fund, which is a $7 million investment and a fund to actually help corner stores be able to incorporate healthy food into their retailing establishments and give them capital, because the financing industry will look at that and say, well, you know, we're not going to finance that type of development, but what we did is create a low-cost option for them to be able to bring that in. And then changing communities overall. So we have a program that we call Healthy Places, where we invested $4.5 million, and we worked with three communities. We picked And we did this in partnership with the Urban Land Institute. Are any of you all familiar with the Urban Land Institute? So we picked them because, if you know, the Urban Land Institute has its primary and their membership base is the development community, right? So we're trying to get them to start thinking about healthy communities and healthy places, and they've really kind of taken fire with this. Their theme this year for their national organization is health and is healthy building and health. How to build a healthy place. So they have their 10 principles. It's very interesting. Very quickly, the phase 1, 2, and 3. We're on phase 3 right now. We funded each one of these communities. We said if you work on developing your concept for how you would develop a healthy community, that we would allow you to apply to us for a grant of $1 million that they could then try to use within their community and leverage additional development. They did that, all three of them. Westwood, which is a very low-income neighborhood on the west side of Denver, Arvada, which is a suburban community, and Lamar, which is in southeastern Colorado, is a rural community. I'm going to quickly go through that. And if you have any questions about that, I'll be happy to answer that. But our insights. We know that we have to work with people across sectors. We know that we have to focus on the built environment. We know that we have to change decisions that are being made every day. And that's the type of work that we're trying to do. And I hope that as we grow further and do more of this type of work, that we'll be able to have more examples to be able to show you of what we're doing within the Health Foundation today. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. I know I have a lot of questions that I've been writing down as both David and Chris spoke. So now join me in welcoming Jeff. Jeff is from New Orleans and is going to be talking to us about what they've been doing here to redevelop New Orleans.
All right. Good morning, everybody. I'm very happy to have another urban planner on the panel. I feel like the worlds of public health and urban planning, the Venn diagrams are slowly starting to overlap a little bit more. I am Jeff Schwartz. I'm the Executive Director of Broad Community Connections. Executive Director is a very highfalutin title for an organization of one person. But I have a really wonderful board of 13 really wonderful small business owners, community members, neighborhood residents, and the like. And I wanted to talk about it. I'm really flattered and honored to be on such an illustrious panel. I'm here to talk about one very specific project we're doing here in New Orleans that I feel like has been set up very well with a lot of things that Christopher and David spoke about that we call the Refresh Project. So just very briefly, who Broad Community Connections is or what it is. We're a neighborhood development organization. We're not formally a community development corporation. We focus very much on sort of linking residents and small business owners with resources. We're not a representative organization like a neighborhood organization. We sort of see ourselves as a capacity builder and working in lockstep with community. Everybody has day jobs. Mine is to work alongside folks to improve a very specific corridor in Broad Street that's called Broad Street. We have a number of strategies. The one I'm going to focus on today is really how we link strategic real estate development with community development and driving health outcomes on the ground in four very particular neighborhoods in the city. So sort of situating ourselves, I probably should have had the convention center on this map. That would have been smart of me. But that's the Mississippi River down there on the lower right. And if you follow that down about, I guess, about a half mile, maybe three quarters of a mile, that's where we are today. So we're probably only about a mile, mile and a half from where we're sitting right now. You can see in orange the Broad Street corridor, and it's sort of a four corners area of the city that runs through really vibrant communities in New Orleans. Many of you have heard of Treme now that the HBO show has aired. It's the first free neighborhood of color in the country. If there's a place where jazz was invented, it's in Treme. And it's a really just culturally resonant community. If you, you know, I've seen images of backstreet traditions like second lines and kids playing trumpet on their porch, that actually happens in Treme every day. There's occasionally, you know, traffic gets stopped because of brass band walking around in the street. Faubourg St. John and Mid-City are on the lake side of Broad Street, and they're generally slightly more affluent communities, but very much diverse communities, very organically mixed-use, mixed-income areas going out towards City Park and Bayou St. John there. And then there's Lower Mid-City, which has been very much a community in transition after Hurricane Katrina. You can see there, those two large green blobs are the, I believe, still the largest hospital development in the entire world right now. It's a $2.2 billion development. It's a VA hospital and the LSU Tulane Xavier Dillard sort of academic medical center. And while it's an incredibly important economic development project, it's very important as sort of the center of the health care sort of world in New Orleans. It very much is an urban renewal style project, and the urban planner in me somewhat cringes at sort of the way that it was designed. It was it's a 72-acre development that probably could have been done in about a quarter of that land. And so that's had a very interesting effect on Lower Mid-City and the community that we our communities that we work in. There's a number of other public housing redevelopment projects, not unlike the Mariposa, the Faubourg Lafitte, and the Iberville Choice neighborhoods, which, as Chris was alluding to, is actually that is the successor to the Hope Six regime at HUD. And so, yeah, I'm sure you knew it. But, yeah, so there's about, give or take, about 2,500 units of housing, mostly either deeply affordable or affordable in the communities that we work in. And there's also the criminal justice complex at one end of the corridor, which is where the criminal courts are, the prison, and about 100 bail bondsman locations, unfortunately. And so the Refresh Project really sits at the center of this area. And to me, it's really important to set the stage because so much of the work that we do, we talk about geography and how your zip code is unfortunately a determinant of where you are and in terms of your health outcomes. This project very much sits at a transition point in the center of four different communities. I don't want to belabor the point. I think we all know the statistics. New Orleans and Louisiana are sort of at the bottom of the pile when it comes to health outcomes. And sort of just as importantly, if not more so, the disparities in New Orleans are equally disheartening. I just have here the difference between African American and white, but there's obviously disparities among all racial and ethnic groups. Food access and food security are also points that they're significant challenges that we work on in our communities as well as New Orleans writ large. And all of this really plays out to this zip code map when you extrapolate it. I should probably have put the location of Refresh Project, but you see that there's sort of that hard line where you transition literally from one side of Broad Street to the other. You go from a life expectancy of in the mid to upper 70s down to the mid to low 50s. And so it's almost a 25-year gap that I know Robert Wood Johnson and others have been sort of not heralding but talking about as one of the sort of defining features of the New Orleans health landscape is this tremendous health disparity. And we're sort of at the epicenter of it. And we see that, again, both as a challenge and an opportunity. That 70112 zip code is the lowest in the city. That's why it's outlined there. We're in 70119, but literally just on the other side of that thick black line. And so as a community development organization, we got started in 2008. Really were founded out of a group of residents and business owners and sort of institutional stakeholders like Catholic Charities, which was actually through its Community Development Corporation redeveloping the Lafitte Public Housing Project. Tulane University, which was focused on developing community health centers. They've been doing amazing work under Karen DeSalvo, who is now in D.C. doing amazing work. But this was really the landscape we faced. In New Orleans, in 2008, this is a map of where grocery stores had reopened at the time, right as we were getting started. And we heard time and time again, we need to, of all the uses that we want to see in the corridor, we need food access. And it was you know, a food desert and an underserved community, really in every sense of the word. And you could see down by the Mississippi River, what is colloquially known as the Sliver by the River, which was largely unscathed by Katrina. It's on high ground. There were probably 8 to 10 grocery stores that had reopened in 2008. Similarly, in some of the outlying suburban areas that were somewhat more affluent, even if they were affected by Katrina, there were grocery stores that had reopened. But then you have that large swath in the middle of the city that, if you remember that zip code map, there's obviously a correlation there between low income and communities of color and the fact that no grocery stores had reopened. And Broad Street is sort of, if you're going to draw one corridor that connected or you were going to try and connect all of those dots, it would be Broad Street. So that was sort of the context that we sort of first launched in. And there was this large 65,000 square foot old grocery store that had actually closed just prior to Katrina. It was a Schwegman's grocery store, a big regional chain that went bankrupt in 2002. Another grocer actually operated in that location until just before Katrina. The owners of the building decided that they wanted to do, I think, a self-storage facility, which, as someone in real estate once told me, is where property goes to die. It has literally zero effect on the community around it. It makes so much money that it's very difficult to ever redevelop it into anything else, unless the community around it dramatically changes. We reached out to the developers of this building after everybody sort of got their feet underneath them. This is about 4 or 5 years after Katrina, in late 2009, early 2010, to see if we could actually do something with the project. I'm going to talk in depth about how we actually got from here to where we are today, which is what we call the Refresh Project. We were fortunate to have a philanthropic partner that was willing to give us a little bit of money to tie the building up on spec. Because of sort of the lack of a real estate market around this site, we're able to tie this building up for about $25,000 for 5 or 6 months, and to start talking to people, to start pounding the pavement and really reach out to grocers and community partners and say, what would you like to see in this site? I feel almost sheepish in taking credit for this project, because what it is really a conglomeration of so many partners who I still can't believe the stars aligned that they were all able to actually create a partnership and come into the Refresh Project. When you walk into the building, you enter a lobby and you can actually see a range of partners. The lobby is actually meant to be a space where you could see the spectrum of services. And it became really apparent to us that food access was just one leg of the stool that we were trying to do here. It was partly practical. We had a 65,000 square foot building that we needed to fill up, but it was very much aspirational. We wanted to not just plunk a grocery store down in an underserved community, which even as a Whole Foods and one of these newer urban format Whole Foods stores, we knew was not going to drive health outcomes and actually moving the needle long term on health outcomes. And so what we did was we started talking to all a number of partners, all the partners that we could think of, that would really help to connect the dots between not only food access, but youth and workforce development, culinary and nutrition education, fitness and gardening classes, education, community economic development, and really start to make linkages between various partners and in a way that actually would drive the positive health outcomes and positive economic changes we wanted to see in the community. So our vision for the Refresh Project was to create the healthiest communities in New Orleans. Got to start somewhere. Eventually, hopefully the healthiest communities in the nation. But this concept is really a community health hub. Just really briefly, the partners in the project are Whole Foods Market, Tulane University, and in particular the Tulane Gold Ring Center for Culinary Medicine, Liberty's Kitchen, Broad Community Connections. We have a nice two-person office in the building. First Line Schools and Edible Schoolyard. First Line Schools is a charter management organization, and they brought Alice Waters' Edible Schoolyard program out of the Bay Area to New Orleans right after Katrina, and they have it featured very prominently at all 5 schools that they run in the city. Boys Town, which is a national organization that works with at-risk youth, and Sprout New Orleans, which is our urban farming partner. I want to say just a quick point about the Gold Ring Center and Liberty's Kitchen. The Gold Ring Center for Culinary Medicine is the first teaching kitchen of its kind in the entire country. Tulane University, it's embedded in their medical school, even though it's on-site at the Refresh Project. Tulane is the first med school in the country to require its medical students to do a culinary and nutrition rotation as a part of going through med school. And it's sort of one of those duh, aha ideas that you wish every med school would actually get on board with. They are working with three distinct populations. One is medical students, as I mentioned. The other is continuing medical education for physicians. So a lot of conferences in town, a lot of doctors in town, as they have to get their CMEs each year. The idea is to get them not to go on continuing medical vacation, but actually come in and actually get educated on knife skills and recipe development and actually translating medical research into practical advice for the patients that they work with. And then just as importantly to us, they have free cooking classes in perpetuity for community members. And so really the idea is that you can walk into Refresh Project and not know a thing about the range of services on site, but you can walk in and directly behind those stairs and that big glass curtain wall, you might see your neighbor taking cooking classes with her aunt. Or you might walk into Whole Foods and meet one of their healthy eating educators, of which they have two on site. They might take you for a value tour in Whole Foods and then connect you with Chef Leah Saris at the Gold Ring Center to then learn how to cook what you made on site. And then the last partner I want to say a little more about is Liberty's Kitchen. They're directly to your left. Liberty's Kitchen is, I'm sure there are similar organizations in many of the communities that you live in. Liberty's Kitchen works with at-risk youth in it's a culinary and hospitality setting, but their whole mission is around teaching young people who've never been given a leg up in anything, life skills and employability skills. The deep food connection there resonates obviously in New Orleans with the food culture we have here and food and hospitality being big business, but it's really about connecting young people to services and the like. And it's very exciting to see the partnerships that Whole Foods and Liberty's Kitchen have already formed. Every day, Liberty's Kitchen actually cooks for the hot and cold salad bar lines and prep food lines in Whole Foods. Whole Foods is a frontline employer for Liberty's Kitchen's graduates. And they're also helping Liberty's Kitchen in their other line of business, which is doing healthy meals from scratch every day for charter schools. And so there's really these amazing partnerships that form, really connecting the dots when you co-locate all of these partners under the same roof. And so the whole idea behind Refresh is, again, this connecting the dots idea that you don't just place things near each other, place service providers near each other or food access outlets near each other. You actually drive the connecting the dots, the actual short-term behavioral changes and knowledge changes and attitude changes so that you can actually reach the long-term health outcomes. And that's really where BCC, Broad Community Connections, comes in. We've always envisioned this. I don't even know if I have license to do it, but I've made up this idea of the three Ps, price, proximity, and programming, which I think speaks to what David was emphasizing about always reducing barriers, always thinking creatively about how you can reduce barriers to food access. Proximity should probably be first because obviously we know that we need to get food access and this kind of programming into communities. That's critically important, but it's sort of a necessary but not sufficient component of driving outcomes. The other piece is price, and I don't mean price just in the sense of labels in the grocery store, which is obviously very important, critically important, but also the affordability of all kinds of services. And so whether that's cooking classes, gardening classes, fitness classes, the ability to say, you know, not just go exercise, but also hold people's hand and get them to providers that can actually get those services affordably. And then lastly, programming, which is sort of a catch-all P, it just was conveniently P. That really speaks to just the need to unite all of these partners and have a partner like a BCC, a sort of quarterback on the ground, who is really the intermediary. I should emphasize that everybody would be successful in this site in their own right. It could just be a glorified strip mall, but we found it critically important that we needed to continue to bring people to the table and continue to align and coordinate all the different partners. And I should mention that we have about 35 organizations from Share Our Strengths, Second Harvest Food Bank, Louisiana Public Health Institute, Tulane Prevention Research Center, Whole Cities Foundation, all the way down through Hip Hop Hula Hoop and our community gardeners, yoga providers, bicycling groups and the like, all sort of working together. We convene everybody once a month, in addition to the on-site partners, once a month to really develop programming. And I'm happy to say that with a grant of the Whole Cities Foundation, we're actually about to roll out a community health outreach program. Probably the first really tangible component of this programming is going to be hiring two community health workers and a coordinator to really continue to break down barriers to access on-site and off-site. And so you can see a picture here. We had our community grand opening just a couple weeks ago on the left. that was sort of celebrating all of the partners being open on site, as well as the community farm that we actually just finished building with entirely volunteer help. You all are public health professionals, and so I don't need to emphasize the importance of evaluation and measurement in everything that we do. I have been firmly bitten by the bug that we need to have an evidence-based approach to everything that we do on site. We were very fortunate that the Tooling Prevention Research Center was actually able, they had some money laying around, which I think almost never happens, and we were able to do a 900 household, or they were able to lead a 900 household survey, both in the neighborhoods around the Refresh Project, as well as in a control neighborhood down in the Upper Ninth Ward neighborhood. It's a neighborhood called Bunny Friend, named after a park down there. Which actually has very similar demographics and health outcomes, but is not getting a grocery store or any of these services, unfortunately. Over time, we're thinking about, you know, one, we need to update the Making Groceries survey. We feel very fortunate in that we have a baseline, so whenever we can raise enough money to go back and do the evaluations, we'll at least be able to compare it to where we were before. But I think just as importantly, if not more so, we want to actually start getting into that obviously is not biometric data. That's just, you know, an in-depth, but more of a behavioral survey. We want to start getting into working with cohorts of diabetic patients, for example, or, you know, folks with obesity that so that we can actually look at what is the impact of this coordinated range of programs on folks who have diabetes. And so we're working with the Tooling Community Health Center on developing a cohort of patients that have diabetes. The thing about diabetes, as I'm sure many of you know, is that you can actually measure daily what the impact of folks' activities and behaviors are. And so we're currently exploring how we're going to actually pilot that. It obviously involves IRBs and the like and HIPAA issues, but we hope to be able to start doing that level of analysis to really just test what works, use that whole .com idea of fail and fail fast. So see what is actually making impacts in people's behaviors. And so that's really where, you know, we got the building open, and that's really what, you know, the work has just started. And so that's really where we're going now. And finally, just a little bit on some of the policy and practice implications in putting projects like this together. They're extraordinarily difficult to put together on the financing side, as Christopher was saying. And the thing that strikes me is that there's really broadly defined two different phases in a project like this. You have everything that goes into the financing and development of a project, which I heard David Erickson from the San Francisco Fed last night say, it's the idea of like the deal, where it's this sort of fetishized thing on, you know, Wall Street and in real estate development circles, and that is very focused on just getting to that closing point. And, you know, maybe you care about who the initial round of tenants are, but it really doesn't speak to what goes on in what I'm just calling the general programming phase, which is really the lifetime of the building. And the thing that I think is where Refresh probably offers something that might be relevant nationally, or hopefully there's more than one, but the broadest idea is that we need to bridge these two phases of community development, broadly defined. And the most concrete example that I can give is that the city of New Orleans actually took some of its post-Katrina community development block grant dollars, put $7 million of it into a pot, asked the CDFI here to raise another $7 million privately, and we have actually created a $14 million fresh food retail initiative in the city, which is very progressive. It's sort of at the you know, I guess, leading thinking of where incentivizing these types of projects are today. But when it comes down to it, when we signed on the dotted line to get this project done, that money really only stipulates, again, only stipulates that 15% of the linear shelf space in the grocery store has to be used for fresh food access. Now, there are some other underwriting requirements, right? We have to, you know, continue operating the building for 5 years and the like. But really, when it comes down to it, that's the teeth in that policy and in that financing. And I would just argue or just observe that does very little to actually drive the long-term outcomes that we're all looking for in this room. And so I think it's critically important. I think that speaks to the role of having the on-the-ground organization, not just a BCC, but public housing authorities or public agencies, public health entities, to be involved with projects from the earliest and get a seat at the table so that you could stay in the project long term. And that does oftentimes involve money, but it doesn't always have to. But it's critically important. You know, we hear a lot about how do you keep community engaged at the table. And in my estimation, you hear a lot about community advisory boards or community benefits agreements. And those are very static arrangements. They sort of recapitulate a lot of the problems of just community engagement in general. And, if we genuinely want to drive these long-term health outcomes, we need to start developing more projects where there's capacity for that built in, that we're not just relying on tax credits or the goodwill of development partners, but that there are partners at the table over the long term. And so I would just offer that as one upshot of the Refresh project. With that, I'm done. Thank you all.